now taking control. The nitty gritty, I give it up to my pick city. Home of plays and pimps, hustles, low track tricks. Silly rap, this ain't for kids, it's how we live in. Check when you're coming down my road. From the burnout kids to the vacant homes. Shit's gotta go, things gotta change. As they change, it still stays the same. Up in the club with the baggy jeans. Looking so fresh, so fresh, so lean. Still tricked, don't leave me rage. Popping off with fruits, better bust now his cage. Comes when it takes my stage. Cause all my drives have been prearranged. Oh, seen a lot of pain. These eyes seen you run your game. These eyes seen the lies you say. These eyes watch you walk away. These eyes. These eyes.
Welcome to Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM. I'm your host, Dustin Rogers, and today on the show, we're starting with a look at two very different subcultures that share one thing in common, competition, and how that pushed Neil Baldwin to become one of the most influential Commodore 64 composers of the 80s and kickstarted his career as a composer. Over the next hour, we'll talk graffiti, CompuNet, demo scene, and much more. You're listening to Square Wave on CKW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Square Wave program starts in 1985, when around the world the global phenomenon known as hip-hop had begun to take root. Hip-hop, for those unfamiliar, would go on to be a cultural zeitgeist that would dominate much of the youth landscape in later decades, but already by the mid-80s it had begun to show signs of its eventual reach and influence. Of course, this was most prominent in the United States, but the United Kingdom also had its own distinct hip-hop flavor emerging. And when I say hip-hop, I'm not talking about rap, although rap obviously is one element of the larger hip-hop culture. Hip-hop is much broader. It encompasses elements such as fashion, breakdancing, beatboxing, graffiti art, and much more. And in fact, these other elements, they used to be much more closely associated with the hip-hop culture, in particular the breakdancing and graffiti scenes, which bore much of the early weight of hip-hop's identity, and these elements were present in 80s hip-hop subcultures around the world. Breakdancing and graffiti in particular are deeply rooted in competition. The graffiti artist's first goal is to tag their name in increasingly more elaborate and colorful ways, outdoing themselves and their rivals in the process. The graffiti artist spends days scoping for the best spot, drafting their art, gathering the right paint and equipment, layering the different elements together, and then under cover of night, the clandestine artist paints their best work on the wall for everyone to see. It is illegal, being dubbed vandalism by the authorities, but it's also a point of pride for the artist, having their work rise above the others in the public square. Although the art is ephemeral, it never lasts long before being repainted or even re-tagged over, the best artists would earn a reputation that would far outlive their work. Let me introduce Neil Baldwin. Born in 1970, he's about 15 years old, living in Manchester, England, and thoroughly entrenched in the early hip-hop subculture. In fact, he's a breakdancer and a graffiti artist who tags under the name Demon. And one evening, Baldwin is arrested, can of paint in hand, half-finished Demon written on the wall behind him. This event puts an abrupt end to Baldwin's career as a graffiti artist. Think of it a bit like taking a serious injury in a pro sport. Sure, you could rehab it, but maybe you've got what you needed out of it and are ready to start the next chapter in your life. I know that for many professional athletes, that competitive drive never really dies. Just think of that Michael Jordan documentary on Netflix, The Last Dance. It's clear that MJ had a competitive drive that just shot through his being. He couldn't leave it all out there on the court. He took that competition to casinos and bookies, clubs and relationships everywhere he went. And it's evident all these years later that 23 is still fired by competition. And Neil Baldwin is a bit, maybe just a bit, but a bit nonetheless, he's a bit like that. No longer allowed to compete against his peers with street art, Baldwin would have to find a new way to push his art on the world. Coming from a working class family and having been taught to play guitar by his father at a young age, Baldwin turned to music for his next creative competitive outlet. But he had another love as well, the Commodore 64. He was never one to sit in front of a screen, but Baldwin had been exposed to the Commodore 64 while hanging out at a friend's place. And the Commodore 64 was an early home computer. More on this in a bit, but it was through this machine that Baldwin discovered the demo scene, an international computer art subculture that focused on creating self-contained, often very small computer programs that, when run, would produce self-playing audio-visual presentations. Again, more on this in the next segment, but Baldwin was immediately hooked. He remembers begging his parents to buy him a Commodore 64, and eventually they did. In an interview years after the fact, Baldwin recalls that the Commodore 64 was, quote, "the machine that spawned a thousand careers," unquote. And it would spawn his as well. But as a child of about 15, 16, he had just begun learning to code and using the computer programming language BASIC to create his own demos using the software known as Electrosound. Working once again under the pseudonym Demon, Baldwin's first song, appropriately titled Demon's First, was created using the primitive three-voice sound chip of the Commodore 64 and released in 1986. Let's hear it now, Demon's first entry into the CompuNet ecosystem, and when I come back, more on the Commodore 64 and Baldwin's rise to the top of its own underground competitive scene. You're listening to Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM. What we just heard was Neil Baldwin's first demo released for the glorious Commodore 64, a platform which released exactly 40 years ago this month. And if you're like me, you weren't alive or technologically inclined in the mid-80s, you've probably never heard of or seen the Commodore 64. It was produced by Commodore Business Machines. It's essentially an early home computer that you could plug into your television. The hardware itself was housed entirely within the keyboard, and it featured various plugs and ports along the side and the back. And it earned its name from the 64 kilobytes of RAM it sported, and it was capable of drawing visuals featuring 16 different officially supported colors. I say officially because the video chip could technically draw up to 128 colors through the use of some clever programming. And the machine could render up to 8 multicolor sprites per scan line, and it featured a custom waveform generator chip to produce its sound. The chip was called the Sound Interface Device, or the SID6581, and it featured 3 independent synthesizer voice channels, each capable of producing different effects and waveforms. I always want to try to keep the technical stuff as easy to understand as possible, partially because this is something that I don't understand all that well myself, but each voice on this chip was capable of running its own operators, which could then bend and shape the different waveforms to produce different sounds, and it was even capable of reproducing a recognizable human voice without additional hardware. This made the Commodore 64 one of the first computers to include a sound chip of this kind, and the best sounding home computer available anywhere near its introductory price point of $595 USD, although that price would eventually be cut down to about $300 a few years later. And the SID6581 is truly an iconic sound chip, not just for its popularity and ubiquity during the 80s decade, but because it was actually capable of producing incredibly punchy sound. In computer historian and local Winnipegger Brian Bagnell's book On the Edge, The Spectacular Rise and Fall of Commodore, he recounts a quote from Charles Winterbull, the team lead that engineered the Commodore 64. And he said of the sound chip, quote, "This thing is already 10 times better than anything out there and 20 times better than it needs to be," unquote. And I'm inclined to agree with Winterbull on this because the Commodore 64's unique sound has far outlived the rest of the machine. In fact, there are professional tools still used today that were designed to emulate the SID6581. Perhaps the most famous is the Electron SID Station, which was at the center of a 2007 plagiarism controversy featuring Finnish demo scene artist Jane Sunni and producer slash record executive Timbaland. The song Do It, written for Nelly Furtado, allegedly took its distinctive synth line from Sunni's track Acid Jazzed Evening, which won first place in the old school music competition at the Assembly 2000 demo party held in Helsinki, Finland. But I'm getting ahead of myself a bit here. What's all this about a demo scene and demo parties and whatnot? Well, the Commodore 64, in addition to having a great sound chip, also had the benefit of being exceptionally easy to program for. And this made it a hotbed for quote-unquote hacking, but unlike the hacking that we're more accustomed to today, many of these hacks more closely resembled something like the indie game scene today. Sure, there was some bypassing of software copy protection going on, but one of the most popular and enduring trends that emerged from this era was that of demos. Demos are basically self-contained audio-visual scripts that could run on the Commodore 64 to turn that machine into, like, your own version of MTV. But instead of the latest pop hits, though, these demos showcase the programming, musical skills, and visual artistry of their creator. Remember, this was a time when most home computers in a product line had very little separation in terms of their base hardware. This meant that code that was written for one Commodore 64 could be played back flawlessly on any other Commodore 64. Ultimately, the biggest differences in demos came down to the individual programmer and their creativity and coding abilities. This created an environment of competition, with different demo scene groups and artists going to great lengths trying to outdo one another in their pursuit of the best visuals and sounds imaginable on the Commodore platform. An entire subculture emerged around the Commodore 64 demos that still exists today, and one of the most important factors in the pre-internet days of computers was a United Kingdom-based service known as CompuNet. CompuNet operated from 1984 to 1993, and it was essentially a subscription-based service that hosted a wide range of user-created content for the Commodore 64. Users could connect their CompuNet modem, affectionately called the brick, to their Commodore 64, and using their home phone line, dial up the CompuNet server. Demo scene artists could then upload their work to a central database, which others could access and vote on, with the best and most impressive works inevitably rising to the top of the digital charts. And for Neil Baldwin, who was still only about 16 years old and recently retired from graffiti art, the demo scene and its competition-focused subculture was a revolution, one that pushed him to become one of the early demo scene elite. Inspired by other demo scene creators like Ron Hubbard and Martin Galway, he would spend hours pushing the hardware of the Commodore 64 to its limit, first with a program called Electrosound, and then later with his own homebrewed tools. As a result, Baldwin, who was still using the pseudonym Demon, became a regular presence on the demo scene boards and released some of the most brilliant and technically impressive demos from the early days of the movement. Let's hear a few examples of what I'm talking about now, a few of the demos created by Neil Baldwin for the Commodore 64, which appeared on the CompuNet servers between 1986 and 1988. This is Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM. We just heard some of Neil Baldwin's music composed on the Commodore 64 between 1986 and 1988. The last song that I played there is one that I bet some keen-eared listeners will recognize. It's a track called Beat Sid, or Beat S-I-D, and on it, Baldwin sampled real drums and the hook from the track Beat Dis by Bomb the Bass. And I talked about Bomb the Bass once on my show before years ago, when I played the soundtrack from Rez, and I talked about how the creator of that game was inspired by the Xenon 2 arcade, which played the song Mega Blast, also by Bomb the Bass, as part of its attract mode. It's funny how the interests and inspirations behind the music of my show overlap so much when you look at it for long enough. But back to Baldwin, though. When he was 16, he left school to take on an engineering apprenticeship. The success of his demos helped him find work as a composer, and the second track we heard in the previous set was the main theme of Shadow Skimmer, a game developed by a company called The Edge, who were a quote-unquote creative group of freelance artists, programmers, and musicians that Baldwin composed for. Baldwin also composed the theme to at least one other game by The Edge. It's called Garfield Big Fat Hairy Deal, and it was based on the titular character from the Jim Davis comic strip. As his work began to get noticed, though, Baldwin's career as a composer changed rapidly. He applied to Maniacs of Noise, who were a Netherlands-based video game music company that was founded in 1987 by Baldwin's fellow demo scene contributors Jorien Tel, aka Wave, and Charles Deenan. He was accepted, but never ended up working for the company because, as Baldwin recalls, a week later he left home to co-found the video game development company Eurocom, along with Ian and Matt Sneap, Tim Rogers, and Hugh Binns. Eurocom came together in 1988 specifically to begin developing games for the Nintendo Entertainment System, but later expanded to other platforms. Baldwin recalls that founding a company was daunting to him and the other young men involved. Quote, "It was scary and exciting in equal measures. We were just kids, really, and much of the process of actually setting up and running the business was taken on by Matt Sneap's dad, Ian. We all knew each other through the C64 scene, so it was like making big demos. But we all sat in an office instead of in one of our bedrooms. Ian Sneap, through his contacts in electronics companies in Japan, got us a foot in the door. So I actually have no idea what was involved in getting approval from Nintendo for us to be an official developer. My role was purely to program and create sound," unquote. And Baldwin's first title released under the Eurocom banner was a game called Magician, released in March 1990 for the Nintendo Entertainment System. The team themselves had no development hardware or previous experience working on the console, but they did have six NES consoles that they brought back from Japan, along with a photocopied hardware specification manual that was written in Japanese. Eventually, the team worked their way through these issues, and Baldwin, along with Tim Rogers, who he credits as being a major help, had created their own custom music driver for the hardware. Baldwin recalls working out the music for Magician on a Yamaha keyboard and manually typing in the pitches and durations into the assembler. It was a time-consuming process, and one that Baldwin calls, quote, "the old-school way," unquote, and he would rely on it throughout his career as a composer. After Magician, Eurocom developed the NES version of James Bond Jr., which Baldwin also composed. And at this point, Baldwin says that the Eurocom team ran out of money, they struggled to find a publisher that wanted to give them work, so a few of the team had to look for freelance work to keep them in the black. Baldwin recalls that he was in a fairly good position, though, as a freelance musician who could work on the NES were hard to come by, so through another Eurocom employee, he was connected to System 3 to compose for their NES port of Ferrari Grand Prix Challenge. Now, that game features 9 fantastic offerings from Baldwin, but there's a bit of a catch. You see, Baldwin wasn't getting paid much for this project, and facing a tight deadline, he actually reuses a track from James Bond Jr. here as the theme for the ranking screen. Although it wasn't caught at the time of release, fans of Baldwin's work were quick to notice when he made the tracks available through his website in 2009. Back to Eurocom, though, the company's fortunes began to turn around when they were assigned to work on the NES and Game Boy versions of Lethal Weapon, which was a collaborative effort between Baldwin's company and Ocean Software, another British developer that I talked briefly about last year when I covered the career of Dean Evans. And these games, the Lethal Weapon games, they were fairly well received despite being extremely difficult, and Baldwin's soundtrack in particular received universal acclaim upon release. Let's hear a selection of tracks from this era of Baldwin's career, including Magician, James Bond Jr., and Ferrari Grand Prix Challenge. I'm definitely going to play the song that appears on both soundtracks, so how could I not? I mean, it's obviously that good. It deserved to be on both, but when I come back, Eurocom shifts to the 16-bit generation. You're listening to Square Wave on CKW 95.9 FM. Welcome back to Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We just heard a series of tracks by Neil Baldwin, who's the composer in the spotlight of today's show, and they were composed for various NES titles from 1990 to 1992, and despite a tumultuous start, as Eurocom approached the middle of the 90s decade, the company that Baldwin helped found had begun to find more stable footing. When it came time for the company to shift to the Super Nintendo, Baldwin spent more and more of his time programming and writing audio code. Baldwin says that the Super Nintendo, which had its own sample-based audio processor, was a pleasure to work with, and he wrote a custom MIDI-based audio system for the platform. Eurocom was able to hire another composer at this time, Steve Duckworth, and he helped take the load off Baldwin. Together, Baldwin and Duckworth make an excellent team, with Duckworth being, by Baldwin's own admission, a much faster and more talented composer than him, and this allowed Baldwin to spend more time managing the programming side of things. And despite being in more of a supervisory role for much of the company's work on the Super Nintendo, Baldwin still contributed to several soundtracks during this time. Together, the duo of Baldwin and Duckworth share a musical credit for the Super Nintendo version of Dino Deenie's Soccer, whereas Baldwin is credited strictly as a programmer on Maui Mallard in Cold Shadow, which is also for the Super Nintendo, with Duckworth taking the full musical credit there. The one game for the Super Nintendo that seems to be purely Baldwin's work was Brutal Paws of Fury, which itself is a port of the Sega CD fighting game of the same name. When it came time for Eurocom to start on Nintendo 64 games, Baldwin found it to be a sharp contrast to the Pleasure Cruise that was working on the Super Nintendo. The composer recalls Nintendo's 3D home console being a nightmare to develop for, and as a result, he relied on third-party tools and off-the-shelf audio solutions for their music. Once again, the compositional duo of Duckworth and Baldwin share a musical credit on the Nintendo 64 port of War Gods, which is actually the first game to use the Zeus game engine that Mortal Kombat 4 was built on, and Eurocom's port of War Gods is actually considered to be an improvement over the base arcade game, so kudos to the team who worked on that. Baldwin is also credited for bringing the music of Mortal Kombat 4 to the console versions, as Eurocom handled the PlayStation and Nintendo 64 ports for that game, although I don't believe he composed any original music for the title. Baldwin did, however, compose the soundtrack for Machine Hunter, which released in 1997 for Sony's PlayStation. This game seems to be a blatant ripoff of an earlier PlayStation game called Loaded. Reviews are pretty harsh, but a few did mention that Baldwin's ominous, techno-driven soundtrack is one of the game's highlights. Machine Hunter would be the only soundtrack Baldwin would compose for the PlayStation, but its competitor, the Nintendo 64, fared a bit better in this regard. Overall, there are two major highlights that stand out from Baldwin's work on the Nintendo 64, and they are Duke Nukem Zero Hour and 007 The World Is Not Enough. And both games were long-awaited sequels to some of the most popular first-person shooters of the decade, so Eurocom had big shoes to fill for both titles. On the Duke Nukem game, Baldwin recalls being overly ambitious. Quote, "I did the music for Duke Nukem Zero Hour 2. I liked that project a lot, but I attempted to do something I don't think I should have on those tools. I tried to record the music and then chop it up into sections that I could loop and layer, as opposed to making MIDI instruments. The timing of the playback was pretty awful, so they ended up sounding quite lumpy, timing-wise," unquote. On The World Is Not Enough, which supported the Pierce Brosnan-led James Bond film of the same name, Baldwin had a near-complete soundtrack ready when word came down from the IP owner that the game couldn't use any of the thematic elements from the movies, including the iconic Bond theme, so he had to change those elements to be unrecognizable to longtime fans of the series. And it was an unfortunate business decision that dismayed players and the composer alike. The World Is Not Enough would also be Baldwin's last video game music project, and after this point, he would become the audio lead at Eurocom, leaving the musical duties strictly to Steve Duckworth and a couple of others. But interestingly, Baldwin's contributions to video game music don't end here. In fact, in some ways, he becomes more prolific in the first decade of the 21st century than any time before. More on that when I come back, but for now, let's take a short break and hear a couple of Baldwin's tracks from the middle and latter years of the 90s. You're listening to Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Square Wave on CKUW 95.9 FM. This week's show is all about the British video game composer Neil Baldwin. He's the person behind the tracks that we just heard. And that set included music from Brutal, Paws of Fury, Dino Dini's Soccer, and 007 The World Is Not Enough, which I already mentioned was Baldwin's final game soundtrack before moving on to the role of audio lead at Eurocom, a role that he would hold from 2000 until Eurocom ceased operations in 2012. And during this time frame, Eurocom produced mostly licensed games that included titles in the Harry Potter and James Bond series, along with a few original properties such as Sphinx and the Cursed Mummy and Dead Space Extraction, with most compositional duties assigned to Steve Duckworth and Baldwin supervising the production. Besides his work at Eurocom, though, Baldwin also became a prolific presence in the chiptune scene and as an early video game documentarian. Thanks to the rise of social media, which offered those with niche interests new ways to connect, the chiptune scene, which shares roots with the demo scene, began to explode, and Baldwin's fame along with it. Baldwin, for his influential early work, began to be recognized as an important and influential chiptune artist and would frequently attend Q&A events, interviews, chiptune gigs, and even work as a collaborator with newer artists on the scene. Baldwin was also responsible for releasing the free NES sound program called Niju, which allowed chiptune artists to easily recreate the sounds of the 8-bit console. In 2009, Baldwin started a blog called Duty Cycle Generator, which was named for the music tool he and Tim Rogers wrote for the Nintendo Entertainment System. And on this blog, Baldwin documents every NES game that he composed in great detail, often sharing his notes track by track. It was through this blog that the world learned about HeroQuest and Eric the Viking, both titles Baldwin composed in the early 90s for the NES, but which never saw a proper release. On his blog, Baldwin also shares the music that would have been featured in these games and offers his thoughts on their development. HeroQuest was created during Baldwin's stint as a freelancer while Eurocom was struggling for funding. Eric the Viking was created in collaboration with a Japanese publisher and based on the Terry Jones comedy of the same name. Unfortunately, Eurocom's difficulty communicating with the foreign publisher led to a breakdown in the relationship, and this game was ultimately left on the shelf. And it's really a shame that neither title released, although I believe that HeroQuest creator Chris Shrigley leaked the game online. And I say it's a shame, though, because both games feature an incredible soundtrack from Baldwin. At a time when his musical and programming prowess seemed to be at their height, looking back, Baldwin calls many of the songs on these games overindulgent, but I have to disagree. The technical abilities that are on display here are second to none, and Baldwin proves once again that he had a knack for making incredible music with limited hardware. It's almost hard to imagine anyone considering NES music to be overindulgent in the first place. It's like saying that cavemen were overindulgent when they made music on a stone lithophone. Look it up. And I think that the fact that Baldwin even makes this assertion is proof of his truly special talent. Before I sign off today, I want to play for you some of the tracks that Baldwin shared from his unreleased games for the NES. So here it is, one track from each game, Eric the Viking and HeroQuest, composed by Neil Baldwin in 1992. You're listening to Square Wave on CKW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.